This is Age of Treason Radio. With your host, Tan Stoffel.
Yaki on Liberalism Part 4. We're getting now into the meat of what Yaki had to say about liberalism itself. This is Chapter 2 of Imperium. At the bottom of page 209, I'd like to reread the last paragraph that I concluded with the last time, just because it ties in very closely to what we're going to get into this time. When it turned its gaze to history, rationalism saw the whole tendency as one toward reason. Man was emerging during all those millennia. He was progressing from barbarism and fanaticism to enlightenment, from superstition to science, from violence to reason, from dogma to criticism, from darkness to light. No more invisible things, no more spirit, no more soul, no more God, no more church and state. The two poles of thought are, quote, the individual, unquote, and, quote, humanity, unquote. Anything separating them is, quote, irrational, unquote. And I want to call attention to him calling humanity and the individual and humanity poles of thought, which I think is appropriate. They are two ends of a spectrum. On the one side, the individual, and on the other, all of humanity. And in between, he's saying what separates them, he leaves it unstated, but what separates the individual and humanity is nation and race. Between individualism, you know, above individualism comes nationalism, and then broader still is racialism, and then broader still is humanism. And, well, let me read what Yaki himself has to say about his description of it as irrational. This branding of things as irrational is in fact correct. Rationalism must mechanize everything, and whatever cannot be mechanized is of necessity irrational. Thus the entirety of history becomes irrational. Its chronicles, its processes, its secret force, destiny. Rationalism itself is a byproduct of a certain stage of development of a high culture is also irrational. Why rationalism follows one spiritual phase, why it exercises its brief sway, why it vanishes once more into religion, these questions are historical, thus irrational. He's tying it there to religion. He says it is a stage beyond religion, and then it's retreating or cycling back into religion. So he, to give him credit, he is talking here about liberalism mutating, at least in a sense mutating. That was one of my previous questions or criticisms of what, you know, his view of it as opposed to what I had discussed previously and other people's views of it, and the main feature of liberalism being its shifting nature, its which I attribute to the shift in power from predominantly Aryans over Europe to Jews having power over Europe and therefore over its politics, its philosophy, its language, and that's what liberalism means to me. And Yaki, of course, being a philosopher, comes at the his view of liberalism is a true view, an aspect of it that has roots in Western philosophy itself. But he did see this shift in it, or at least that it was a phase in a larger shift. Let's say, put it that way. Liberalism is rationalism in politics. So he's directly connecting, you know, he's been saying that liberalism springs from rationalism. I just want to emphasize here that in his discussion of rationalism and his critique of rationalism, he's critiquing liberalism, basically, because he's saying that liberalism is rationalism. It's just the expression of rationalism in politics, in the making of policy. It rejects the state as an organism and can only see it as the result of a contract between individuals. The purpose of life has nothing to do with states, for they have no independent existence. Thus, the happiness of the individual becomes the purpose of life. Bentham made this as coarse as it could be made in collectivizing it into, quote, the greatest happiness of the greatest number, unquote. If herding animals could talk, they would use this slogan against the wolves. To most humans, who are the mere material of history and not actors in it, happiness means economic well-being. Reason is quantitative, not qualitative, and thus makes the average man into quote-unquote man. Man is a thing of food, clothing, shelter, social and family life, and leisure. Politics sometimes demands sacrifice of life for invisible things. This is against happiness and must not be. Economics, however, is not against happiness, but is almost coextensive with it. Religion and church wish to interpret the whole of life on the basis of invisible things, and so militate against happiness. Social ethics, on the other hand, secure economic order, thus promote happiness. So Yaki's really down on man. I didn't bother to mention the quotes throughout there, but man and happiness both have sneer quotes around most of the instances that he refers to them. Jeremy Bentham was a contemporary of Thomas Jefferson, and this mention of happiness brought to mind immediately for me that, you know, Thomas Jefferson's famous phrase in the Declaration of Independence, a liberal document, an expression of liberalism, about the pursuit of happiness and that the purpose of that people were forming this government, this breakaway government, going to wage war for self-determination in the United States, what was to become the United States, was the pursuit of happiness. And that's what I thought of first, but I don't think Jefferson was influenced by Bentham. It's more that they were just swimming in the same philosophical background at the same time, the same streams of thought going on, because Bentham would have been in his mid-20s at the time Jefferson was writing the Declaration of Independence using that phrase. But Yaki isn't more specific than Bentham when he talks about happiness. What stands out, well, just one more thought about this too. The Yaki ties directly here the happiness to economics, materialism. He equates the two. What's the phrase he uses? He says they're coextensive, that economics and happiness are coextensive, which is just a fancy way of saying that they're equated, they're connected directly. I would say about it too is that and one reason to be down on happiness is it's an emotional state pretty much restricted to individuals, that it's not something that can be felt by or is natural or inherent to groups or larger organisms. I guess to the extent that they are an organism and they function as an organism, as a whole, and have an individual personality in a sense, even if they are made up of collective smaller bits and pieces, that it can experience happiness. But liberalism, of course, and Yaki makes this point that the emphasis is on individualism as well as humanism, but mainly on individualism. The phrase there that he uses, that reason is quantitative, not qualitative, and thus makes the average man into, quote, man, unquote, stands out to me. I think, first of all, saying that reason is quantitative, not qualitative, is, I think I understand what he's getting at there, you know, his view of reason is that it has to mechanize, and it's, you know, but then again, my understanding of rationalism, which is, you know, applied reason, is that it's, the criticism of it by empiricists is that, it goes beyond the senses, that it starts to generalize, that it starts to, notice patterns and create things that aren't real, create knowledge that isn't connected directly to the senses, right? That's the criticism of rationalism. And so it is qualitative in that sense. It goes beyond the simple quantitative of what the senses are measuring, and it does start to embrace a larger whole. But that's, you know, I'm getting a little too philosophical there, I think. Picking nits a bit. And the second part of that sentence about that it makes the average man into man. Now, there's something that Yaki has not dealt with directly in what I've read, at least here so far in these parts, is the egalitarianism that's associated with liberalism, that strand of liberalism that's based on this need to make man equal, to make everyone equal. Yaki has not address that directly, but here, in a sense, it's indirectly addressed. That is what makes the average man into quote unquote man. The stand-in for all man is the average. That we downplay the lesser men and the greater men because we want everyone to be equal. From a liberal mindset there. He states clearly that liberalism, he sees it as rationalism expressed, philosophical rationalism expressed in politics. And again, I already jumped into it, but just to review what we've already covered, the basic phases of Western philosophy, starting with empiricism, it goes back farther, but at least before the period of time that we're focused on here with liberalism, there's empiricism, which begat rationalism, which begat pragmatism, which Yaki described the last time as being the suicide of reason, sort of the end of rationalism, where it offs itself, I guess. Jeremy Bentham, as I said, was a contemporary of Thomas Jefferson, so around about that same period of time, that he was the founder of utilitarianism, this idea that the greatest happiness or benefit of wealth of the greatest number is what utilitarianism amounts to. And he was influenced by empiricists like Locke and Hume, and he in turn then influenced later liberals like John Stuart Mill from the Internet Encyclopedia of Philosophy on Bentham. Bentham developed an ethical theory grounded in a largely empiricist account of human nature. He famously held a hedonistic account of both motivation and value, according to which what is fundamentally valuable and what ultimately motivates us is pleasure and pain. Happiness, according to Bentham, is thus a matter of experiencing pleasure and lack of pain. Now, that's distinct from what Yaki said, equating happiness to economic well-being. Bentham saw it in terms of pleasure and pain. Now, you could say that the pleasure and the pain, that economic well-being is one way to cause pleasure or pain through economics. But I think that the statement that it's happiness is in terms of pleasure and pain is a more general statement, to be fair, to Bentham. Now, about this issue with the word poles and the term poles, as Yaki's already applied it, I think, correctly to individualism and humanism, or in the individual and humanity as two ends of two poles of a continuum, we get here into, I think, a misuse of the word. But it seems he's using it for rhetorical purposes. He wants to say some things, and he wants to tie them together. And so here's what he says. Here, Liberalism found its two poles of thought, economics and ethics. They correspond to individual and humanity. The ethics, of course, is purely social, materialistic. If older ethics is retained, its former metaphysical foundation is forgotten, and it is promulgated as a social and not a religious imperative. Ethics is necessary to maintain the order necessary as a framework for economic activity. Within that framework, however, quote, the individual, unquote, must be, quote, free, unquote. This is the great cry of liberalism, freedom. Man is only himself and is not tied to anything except by choice. Thus, quote, society, unquote, is the, quote, free, unquote, association of men and groups. The state, however, is unfreedom, compulsion, violence. The church is spiritual unfreedom. I think, what he's trying to do there, he's trying to say that economics and ethics are poles as well, and they aren't really. As he's already said, the ethics, which are really just moral values, are expressed in terms of economics. That's what materialism is when you express your what's good and what's bad in terms of what it means economically. And that's his view of liberalism. One of the strands of liberalism is that it is based on economics, and that it bases its ethics on economics in large part. So they're not really, you know, poles are sort of opposites. They're two ends of a spectrum, and you can't really put ethics on one end of a spectrum and economics on the other. And he doesn't. Yaki doesn't in his example. It's just he's, as I say, using a rhetorical. It's just for rhetorical purposes that he uses the same word, I think, there. But it caused me some confusion in trying to understand what he was getting at. I was trying to find the correspondence, as he tries to draw it, between individuals and economics on the one side, and the other pole being humanity and ethics. Economics, for instance, to me seems just as tied up with humanity as it is with individuals. You've got microeconomics, you've got macroeconomics, you've got an ethics, I guess, is inherently social and involving a group because it really has to do with how individuals treat each other. It's not really something that's private and restricted to an individual. So it just doesn't fit the connection he's trying to make there. I think what he's getting at, though, is he's reiterating a point that he made earlier about seeing liberalism, what he calls liberalism, what he sees as liberalism, as being opposed to authority. And he sees the state and the church as representatives, as proxies or as expressions of authority. So those are poles. That's where the word pole really would apply. You see on two ends of a spectrum there, that on the one end you've got authority, on the other you've got liberalism, and they're opposed to each other. Again, he uses a lot of scare quotes around words like the individual and around freedom. But it's significant here that he finally mentions what most lay people would say is the one of the core principles of liberalism or liberals, is this, that it's inherent in the word itself. Liberal is freedom. That's the number one thing about liberalism. And he says some more now about this freedom as well. All things in the political domain were transvalued by liberalism. War was transformed into either competition, seen from the economic pole, or ideological difference, seen from the ethical pole. Instead of the mystical, rhythmical alternation of war and peace, it sees only the perpetual concurrence of competition or ideological contrast, which in no case becomes hostile or bloody. The state becomes society or humanity on the ethical side, a production and trade system on the economic side. The will to accomplish a political aim is transformed into the making of a program of, quote, social ideals, unquote, on the ethical side, of calculation on the economic side. Power becomes propaganda, ethically speaking, and regulation, economically speaking. The point he's making here, I think, is that he's trying to say it's rather than poles, think of it as X and Y axis, that ethics and economics form a sort of X and a Y that give you the ability to describe a two-dimensional plane, which is great. It's more flexible than a single pole, really, a single continuum, a single line, which is one-dimensional. Two dimensions is better. But the problem, and he doesn't say this, this is my own understanding of it, is what happens when what you're trying to represent is more than two dimensions, three dimensions or more. When you see it through a two-dimensional lens, through just either economics or ethics, then it's reduced, it's squished, it's distorted. Your view of it is distorted. And that seems to be the point he's trying to make here, is that that liberalism squishes things down to be seen in one of these two ways. And thus power, what he says about power there, that power basically is the ability to dictate morals through propaganda or set the regulations, set the laws for a quote-unquote society. Yeah, that's what power is. That's what political power is, the ability to define what the policies are. The purest expression of the doctrine of liberalism was probably that of Benjamin Constant. In 1814, he set forth his views on the, quote, progress, unquote, of, quote, man, unquote. He looked upon the 18th century Enlightenment with its intellectualistic humanitarian cast as merely preliminary to the true liberation, that of the 19th century. Economics, industrialism, and technics represented the means of, quote, freedom, unquote. Rationalism was the natural ally of this trend. Feudalism, reaction, war, violence, state, politics, authority, all were overcome by the new idea, supplanted by reason, economics, freedom, progress, and parliamentarism. So there's two poles or multiple opposites there that Yockey lists out. He sees on the one side feudalism, reaction, war, violence, state, politics, and authority, and on the other, reason, economics, freedom, progress, parliamentarianism. In his understanding of Benjamin Constant's view of liberalism, this is not necessarily Yockey's view. It's Constant's view through Yockey's eyes, call it that. War, being violent and brutal, was unreasonable and is replaced by trade, which is intelligent and civilized. War is condemned from every standpoint. Economically, it is a loss even to the victor. The new war technics, quote, artillery, unquote, made personal heroism senseless. And thus the charm and glory of war departed with its economic usefulness. Yeah. In earlier times, war peoples had subjugated trading peoples, but no longer. Now, trading peoples step out as the masters of the earth. That's an oblique reference to the Jews. Not that Yockey was afraid to talk about the Jews. He did talk about them quite a bit elsewhere in the book, but that particular reference there is almost certainly to the Jews. Now, the interesting thing here, and I'd like to make a point here about Benjamin Constant and about Jewish influence. I said, I wrote it on the end of the post and to go along with the comments that I made at the end of the last installment, that I thought Yockey was in error in attributing the suppression of nation and race, the ideas of nation and race. As I've said, I see they're depressed as well. I see that they're artificially depressed. I don't attribute that to liberalism. I attribute it to Jewish influence. It's clear that the Jews are responsible to the extent that they have the power now over the media and over the politics and over law and over education to pathologize and demonize nation and race, at least when white people express those identities and any sort of favorable opinion about them. Then we're stupid, crazy, or evil, according to the Jews. And so I don't attribute that to liberalism. But I acknowledge that Yockey was writing 60-odd years ago, or a bit more, in the wake of World War II. And he did not see all of the things that have unfolded since then, in the decades since, that we today, looking back, have the privilege or the benefit of hindsight to see what's happened and how the Jews, the power that the Jews have over society now, isn't something new. It's just been unveiled, essentially. About Jewish influence and Benjamin Constant in particular, I read a little bit about Constant. Constant was one of the first thinkers to go by the name liberal. So he was an early liberal, not necessarily the best expression, the purest expression of the doctrine of liberalism as Yaki saw it. I took that as Yaki basically describing Constant as his ideal of what he meant when he talked about liberalism, that this man, Constant, and Constant's beliefs are, to him, the epitome, the purest expression of the liberalism that Yaki is criticizing, describing and criticizing what he thinks of as liberalism. And his description so far has been basically what Benjamin Constant's ideas represented. Constant had, interestingly enough, in Wikipedia they describe it, he made a distinction. He drew a distinction between the, quote, liberty of the ancients and the liberty of the moderns, his own form of liberalism. But he saw liberalism tracing back in history, into the past, as I think you can do. You can see that it's, you know, the Aryan peoples and the remnants of Aryanism, that the aristocracy that was the hierarchy of the church even, and the aristocracy, the nobility, that the rulers of the of society at that time, or the various societies of Europe, and the military caste, the hierarchy in those three branches is Aryan in nature. It's something left, a remnant of the Aryan conquests of Europe, millennia past, and the transition between the liberty of the ancients that Benjamin Constant described and the liberty of the moderns that he was part of at the dawn of, at the beginning of, is that start of the switchover from Aryan rule over Europe, domination of Europe in thought and in deed, to a Jewish rule of Europe. And he didn't know it. Benjamin Constant, I don't think, knew it, but I don't think he would have objected to it, because that's also where Jewish influence comes in, is that he was raised by Huguenot parents. And the Huguenots are a sect of Christianity, Protestantism, that is well known for its sympathies with the Jews. There's an article I'll link that describes how they hid the Jews during World War II, and mentions this long history of Huguenot affinity with the Jews, traceable to the origins of French Protestantism and Calvinism. And the lasting Huguenot sympathy for the Jewish people. Where does this come from? Well, wherever it comes from, it comes in part, I think, from crypto-Jews, Murano Jews, Sephardic Jews that were leaving Spain, came to France, and they, quote-unquote, converted to Christianity and became, in large part, the Huguenots. But it's also, you know, even if it's not in the blood, it seems to be in the spirit of the Huguenots, that the people who are Huguenots, they identify with the Jews as a oppressed minority. And that's a strand of liberalism, that from the earliest days, that anti-racism, got to protect the minorities from the majority. So as we see, liberalism, you can see the influence, the Jewish influence, as far back as you want to go.